He was eating a light supper at 9 in the evening when the front door cried out in the hall, and Mildred ran from the parlor like a native fleeing an eruption of Vesuvius. Mrs. Phelps and Mrs. Bowles came through the front door and vanished into the volcano's mouth with martinis in their hands. Montag stopped eating. They were like a monstrous crystal chandelier tinkling in 1,000 chimes. He saw their Cheshire cat smiles burning through the walls of the house, and now they were screaming at each other above the din. Montag found himself at the parlor door with his food still in his mouth. "Doesn't everyone look nice? Nice! You look fine, Millie. Fine. Everyone looks swell. Swell!" Montag stood watching them. "Patience," whispered Faber. "I shouldn't be here," whispered Montag almost to himself. "I should be on my way back to you with the money."
"Tomorrow's time enough. Careful." "Isn't this show wonderful?" cried Mildred. "Wonderful."
On one wall, a woman smiled and drank orange juice simultaneously. How does she do both at once, thought Montag, insanely. In the other walls, an X-ray of the same woman revealed the contracting journey of the refreshing beverage on its way to her delighted stomach. Abruptly, the room took off on a rocket flight into the clouds. It plunged into a lime-green sea where blue fish ate red and yellow fish. A minute later, 3 white cartoon clowns chopped off each other's limbs to the accompaniment of immense incoming tides of laughter. 2 minutes more, and the room whipped out of town to the jet cars wildly circling an arena, bashing and backing up and bashing each other again. Montag saw a number of bodies fly in the air.
"Millie, did you see that? I saw it. I saw it."
Montag reached inside the parlor wall and pulled the main switch. The images drained away, as if the water had been let from a gigantic crystal bowl of hysterical fish. The 3 women turned slowly and looked with unconcealed irritation and then dislike at Montag. "When do you suppose the war will start?" he said. "I notice your husbands aren't here tonight."
"Oh, they come and go," said Mrs. Phelps. "In again, out again, Finnegan. The army called Pete yesterday. He'll be back next week. The army said so. Quick war. 48 hours, they said, and everyone home. That's what the army said. Quick war. Pete was called yesterday, and they said he'd be back next week. Quick."
The 3 women fidgeted and looked nervously at the empty mud-colored walls.
"I'm not worried," said Mrs. Phelps. "I'll let Pete do all the worrying."
She giggled.
"I'll let old Pete do all the worrying. Not me, I'm not worried." "Yes," said Millie. "Let old Pete do the worrying. It's always someone else's husband dies, they say." "I've heard that too. I've never known any dead man killed in a war. Killed jumping off buildings, yes, like Gloria's husband last week. But from wars? No." "Not from wars," said Mrs. Phelps. "Anyway, Pete and I always said, no tears, nothing like that. It's our 3rd marriage each, and we're independent. Be independent, we always said. He said, if I get killed off, you just go right ahead and don't cry, but get married again and don't think of me." "That reminds me," said Mildred. "Did you see that Clara Dove 5-minute romance last night in your wall? Well, it was about this woman who..."
Montag said nothing, but stood looking at the women's faces, as he had once looked at the faces of saints in a strange church he had entered when he was a child. The faces of those enameled creatures meant nothing to him, though he talked to them and stood in that church for a long time, trying to be of that religion, trying to know what that religion was, trying to get enough of the raw incense and special dust of the place into his lungs, and thus into his blood, to feel touched and concerned by the meaning of the colorful men and women with the porcelain eyes and the blood-ruby lips. But there was nothing, nothing. It was a stroll through another store, and his currency strange and unusable there, and his passion cold, even when he touched the wood and plaster and clay. So it was now, in his own parlor, with these women twisting in their chairs under his gaze, lighting cigarettes, blowing smoke, touching their sun-fired hair, and examining their blazing fingernails, as if they had caught fire from his look. Their faces grew haunted with silence. They leaned forward at the sound of Montag swallowing his final bite of food. They listened to his feverish breathing. The 3 empty walls of the room were like the pale brows of sleeping giants now, empty of dreams. Montag felt that if you touched these three staring brows, you would feel a fine salt sweat on your fingertips. The perspiration gathered with the silence and the sub-audible trembling around and about and in the women who were burning with tension. Any moment they might hiss a long, sputtering hiss and explode. Montag moved his lips. "Let's talk." The women jerked and stared. "How are your children, Mrs. Phelps?" he asked.
"You know I haven't any. No one in his right mind, the good Lord knows, would have children," said Mrs. Phelps, not quite sure why she was angry with this man.
"I wouldn't say that," said Mrs. Bowles. "I've had 2 children by cesarean section. No use going through all that agony for a baby. The world must reproduce, you know, the race must go on. Besides, they sometimes look just like you, and that's nice. 2 cesareans turned the trick, yes, sir." "Oh, my doctor said cesareans aren't necessary. You've got the hips for it, everything's normal, but I insisted. Cesareans are not, children are ruinous. You're out of your mind," said Mrs. Phelps. "I plunk the children in school 9 days out of 10. I put up with them when they come home 3 days a month. It's not bad at all. You heave them into the parlor and turn the switch. It's like washing clothes. Stuff laundry in and slam the lid." Mrs. Bowles tittered. "They just as soon kick as kiss me. Thank God I can kick back."
The women showed their tongues, laughing. Mildred sat a moment, and then, seeing that Montag was still in the doorway, clapped her hands.
"Let's talk politics, to please Guy."
"Sounds fine," said Mrs. Bowles. "I voted last election, same as everyone, and I laid it on the line for President Noble. I think he's one of the nicest-looking men ever became president."
"Oh, but the man they ran against him. He wasn't much, was he? Kind of small and homely, and he didn't shave too close or comb his hair very well. What possessed the outs to run him? You just don't go running a little short man like that against a tall man. Besides, he mumbled. Half the time I couldn't hear a word he said, and the words I did hear I didn't understand. Fat, too, and didn't dress to hide it. No wonder the landslide was for Winston Noble. Even their names helped. Compare Winston Noble to Hubert Hoag for 10 seconds, and you can almost figure the results."
"Damn it," cried Montag. "What do you know about Hoag and Noble?"
"Why, they were right in that parlor wall not 6 months ago. One was always picking his nose. It drove me wild."
"Well, Mr. Montag," said Mrs. Phelps, "do you want us to vote for a man like that?"
Mildred beamed.
"You just run away from the door, Guy, and don't make us nervous."
But Montag was gone, and back in a moment, with a book in his hand.
"Guy."
"Damn it all, damn it all, damn it."
"What have you got there? Isn't that a book? I thought that all special training these days was done by film."
Mrs. Phelps blinked.
"You reading up on fireman theory?"
"Theory, hell," said Montag. "It's poetry."
"Montag," a whisper.
"Leave me alone." Montag felt himself turning in a great circling roar and buzz and hum.
"Montag, hold on. Don't.
Did you hear them? Did you hear these monsters talking about monsters? Oh, God, the way they jabber about people and their own children and themselves, and the way they talk about their husbands, and the way they talk about war. Damn it, I stand here and I can't believe it."
"I didn't say a single word about any war, I'll have you know," said Mrs. Phelps. "As for poetry, I hate it," said Mrs. Bowles.
"Have you ever heard any?"
"Montag," Faber's voice scraped away at him. "You'll ruin everything. Shut up, you fool."
All 3 women were on their feet. "Sit down." They sat.
"I'm going home," quavered Mrs. Bowles. "Montag, Montag, please, in the name of God. What are you up to?" pleaded Faber. "Why don't you just read us one of those poems from your little book?"
Mrs. Phelps nodded.
"I think that'd be very interesting." "That's not right," wailed Mrs. Bowles. "We can't do that." "Well, look at Mr. Montag. He wants to. I know he does. And if we listen nice, Mr. Montag will be happy, and then maybe we can go on and do something else."
She glanced nervously at the long emptiness of the walls enclosing them.
"Montag, go through with this and I'll cut off. I'll leave."
The beetle jabbed his ear.
"What good is this? What'll you prove?"
"Scare hell out of them, that's what. Scare the living daylights out." Mildred looked at the empty air.
Now, Guy, just who are you talking to?
A silver needle pierced his brain. Montag, listen, only one way out. Play it as a joke. Cover up. Pretend you aren't mad at all. Then, walk to your wall incinerator and throw the book in. Mildred had already anticipated this in a quavery voice.
Ladies, once a year every fireman's allowed to bring one book home from the old days to show his family how silly it all was, how nervous that sort of thing can make you, how crazy. Guy's surprise tonight is to read you one sample to show how mixed up things were, so none of us will ever have to bother our little old heads about that junk again. Isn't that right, darling?
He crushed the book in his fists.
Say yes.
His mouth moved, like Faber's. Yes. Mildred snatched the book with a laugh.
Here, read this one. No, I take it back. Here's that real funny one you read out loud today. Ladies, you won't understand a word. It goes umpty-tumpty-ump. Go ahead, Guy, that page, dear.
He looked at the opened page. A fly stirred its wings softly in his ear.
Read.
What's the title, dear?
Dover Beach. His mouth was numb.
Now read in a nice, clear voice. And go slow.
The room was blazing hot. He was all fire. He was all coldness. They sat in the middle of an empty desert with three chairs and him standing, swaying, and him waiting for Mrs. Phelps to stop straightening her dress hem, and Mrs. Bowles to take her fingers away from her hair. Then he began to read in a low, stumbling voice that grew firmer as he progressed from line to line. And his voice went out across the desert into the whiteness and around the three sitting women there in the great hot emptiness. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear, and naked shingles of the world. The chairs creaked under the three women. Montag finished it out. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light, nor certitude nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Mrs. Phelps was crying. The others in the middle of the desert watched her crying grow very loud as her face squeezed itself out of shape. They sat not touching her, bewildered with her display. She sobbed uncontrollably. Montag himself was stunned and shaken.
Shh, shh, said Mildred. You're all right, Clara. Now, Clara, snap out of it. Clara, what's wrong?
I,
sobbed Mrs. Phelps.
Don't know. Don't know. I just don't know. Oh. Oh.
Mrs. Bowles stood up and glared at Montag.
You see? I knew it. That's what I wanted to prove. I knew it would happen. I've always said poetry and tears, poetry and suicide and crying and awful feelings, poetry and sickness, all that mush. Now I've had it proved to me. You're nasty, Mr. Montag. You're nasty.
Faber said,
now.
Montag felt himself turn and walk to the wall slot and drop the book in through the brass notch to the waiting flames.
Silly words, silly words, silly, awful, hurting words, said Mrs. Bowles. Why do people want to hurt people? Not enough hurt in the world? You got to tease people with stuff like that? Clara, now, Clara,
begged Mildred, pulling her arm.
Come on, let's be cheery. You turn the family on now. Go ahead. Let's laugh and be happy now. Stop crying. We'll have a party.
No, said Mrs. Bowles. I'm trotting right straight home. You want to visit my house and my family? Well and good, but I won't come in this fireman's crazy house again in my lifetime.
Go home. Montag fixed his eyes upon her quietly. Go home and think of your first husband divorced, and your second husband killed in a jet, and your third husband blowing his brains out. Go home and think of the dozen abortions you've had. Go home and think of that, And your damn cesarean sections, too, and your children who hate your guts. Go home. And think how it all happened. And what did you ever do to stop it? Go home. Go home! He yelled. Before I knock you down and kick you out the door. Doors slammed, and the house was empty. Montag stood alone in the winter weather, with the parlor walls the color of dirty snow. In the bathroom, water ran. He heard Mildred shake the sleeping tablets into her hand. Fool, Montag, fool, fool, oh God, you silly fool.
Shut up.
He pulled the green bullet from his ear and jammed it into his pocket. It sizzled faintly.
Fool. Fool.
He searched the house and found the books where Mildred had stacked them behind the refrigerator. Some were missing, and he knew that she had started on her own slow process of dispersing the dynamite in her house, stick by stick. But he was not angry now, only exhausted and bewildered with himself. He carried the books into the backyard and hid them in the bushes near the alley fence. For tonight only, he thought, in case she decides to do any more burning. He went back through the house. Mildred! He called at the door of the darkened bedroom. There was no sound. Outside, crossing the lawn, on his way to work, he tried not to see how completely dark and deserted Clarice McClellan's house was. On the way downtown, he was so completely alone with his terrible error that he felt the necessity for the strange warmness and goodness that came from a familiar and gentle voice speaking in the night. Already in a few short hours, it seemed that he had known Faber a lifetime. Now he knew that he was two people, that he was, above all, Montag, who knew nothing, who did not even know himself a fool, but only suspected it. And he knew that he was also the old man who talked to him, and talked to him as the train was sucked from one end of the night city to the other, on one long, sickening gasp of motion. In the days to follow, and in the nights when there was no moon, and in the nights when there was a very bright moon shining on the earth, the old man would go on with this talking, and this talking, drop by drop, stone by stone, flake by flake. His mind would well over at last, and he would not be Montag anymore. This the old man told him, assured him, promised him. He would be Montag plus Faber, fire plus water. And then one day, after everything had mixed and simmered and worked away in silence, there would be neither fire nor water, but wine. Out of two separate and opposite things, a third. And one day he would look back upon the fool and know the fool. Even now he could feel the start of the long journey, the leave-taking, the going away from the self he had been. It was good listening to the beetle hum, the sleepy mosquito buzz and delicate filigree murmur of the old man's voice, at first scolding him and then consoling him in the late hour of night as he emerged from the steaming subway toward the firehouse world. Pity, Montag. Pity. Don't haggle and nag them. You were so recently of them yourself. They are so confident that they will run on forever. But they won't run on. They don't know that this is all one huge, big, blazing meteor that makes a pretty fire in space, but that someday it'll have to hit. They see only the blaze, the pretty fire, as you saw it. Montag, old men who stay at home afraid, tending their peanut brittle bones, have no right to criticize. Yet you almost killed things at the start. Watch it. I'm with you, remember that. I understand how it happened. I must admit that your blind raging invigorated me. God, how young I felt. But now, I want you to feel old. I want a little of my cowardice to be distilled in you tonight. The next few hours when you see Captain Beatty, tiptoe round him. Let me hear him for you. Let me feel the situation out. Survival is our ticket. Forget the poor silly women.
I made them unhappier than they have been in years, I think, said Montag. It shocked me to see Mrs. Phelps cry. Maybe they're right. Maybe it's best not to face things. To run, have fun. I don't know. I feel guilty.
No, you mustn't. If there were no war, if there was peace in the world, I'd say fine, have fun. But Montag, you mustn't go back to being just a fireman. All isn't well with the world.
Montag perspired.
Montag, you listening?
My feet, said Montag. I can't move them. I feel so damn silly, my feet won't move.
Listen. Easy now, said the old man gently. I know. You're afraid of making mistakes. Don't be. Mistakes can be profited by. Man, when I was younger, I shoved my ignorance in people's faces. They beat me with sticks. By the time I was 40, my blunt instrument had been honed to a fine cutting point for me. If you hide your ignorance, no one will hit you, and you'll never learn. Now pick up your feet, into the firehouse with you. We're twins. We're not alone anymore. We're not separated out in different parlors with no contact between. If you need help when Beatty pries at you, I'll be sitting right here in your eardrum making notes.
Montag felt his right foot, then his left foot, move. Old man, he said, stay with me. The mechanical hound was gone. Its kennel was empty and the firehouse stood all about in plaster silence, and the orange salamander slept with its kerosene in its belly and the fire throwers crossed upon its flanks. And Montag came in through the silence and touched the brass pole and slid up in the dark air, looking back at the deserted kennel, his heart beating, pausing, beating. Faber was a gray moth, asleep in his ear for the moment. Beatty stood near the drop hole waiting, but with his back turned as if he were not waiting. Well, he said to the men playing cards, here comes a very strange beast, which in all tongues is called a fool. He put his hand to one side, palm up, for a gift. Montag put the book in it. Without even glancing at the title, Beatty tossed the book in the trash basket and lit a cigarette. Who are a little wise, the best fools be. Welcome back, Montag. I hope you'll be staying with us now that your fever is done and your sickness over. Sit in for a hand of poker? They sat and the cards were dealt. In Beatty's sight, Montag felt the guilt of his hands. His fingers were like ferrets that had done some evil and now never rested, always stirred and picked and hid in pockets, moving from under Beatty's alcohol-flame stare. If Beatty so much as breathed on them, Montag felt that his hands might wither, turn over on their sides, and never be shocked to life again. They would be buried the rest of his life in his coat sleeves, forgotten. For these were the hands that had acted on their own, no part of him. Here was where the conscience first manifested itself to snatch books, dart off with Job and Ruth and Willie Shakespeare, and now in the firehouse, these hands seemed gloved with blood. Twice in half an hour, Montag had to rise from the game and go to the latrine to wash his hands. When he came back, he hid his hands under the table. Beatty laughed. Let's have your hands in sight, Montag. Not that we don't trust you, understand, but... They all laughed. Well, said Beatty, the crisis is past, and all is well. The sheep returns to the fold. We're all sheep who have strayed at times. Truth is truth. To the end of reckoning, we've cried. They are never alone that are accompanied with noble thoughts. We've shouted to ourselves, sweet food of sweetly uttered knowledge, Sir Philip Sidney said. But on the other hand, words are like leaves, and where they most abound, much fruit of sense beneath is rarely found. Alexander Pope. What do you think of that, Montag? I don't know.
Careful, whispered Faber, living in another world far away. Or this. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian spring. There shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again. Pope, same essay. Where does that put you? Montag bit his lip. I'll tell you, said Beatty, smiling at his cards. That made you, for a little while, a drunkard. Read a few lines, and off you go over the cliff. Bang! You're ready to blow up the world, chop off heads. Knock down women and children, destroy authority. I know. I've been through it all.
I'm all right, said Montag nervously.
Stop blushing. I'm not needling, really, I'm not. Do you know? I had a dream an hour ago. I lay down for a cat nap, and in this dream, you and I, Montag, got into a furious debate on books. You towered with rage, yelled quotes at me. I calmly parried every thrust. Power, I said. And you, quoting Dr. Johnson, said, knowledge is more than equivalent to force. And I said, well, Dr. Johnson also said, dear boy, that he is no wise man that will quit a certainty for an uncertainty. Stick with the fireman, Montag. All else is dreary chaos.
Don't listen, whispered Faber. He's trying to confuse. He's slippery. Watch out.
Beatty chuckled. And you said, quoting, truth will come to light. Murder will not be hid long. And I cried in good humor, oh God, he speaks only of his horse. And the devil can cite scripture for his purpose. And you yelled, this age thinks better of a gilded fool than of a threadbare saint in wisdom's school. And I whispered gently, the dignity of truth is lost with much protesting. And you screamed, carcasses bleed at the sight of the murderer. And I said, patting your hand, what, do I give you trench mouth? And you shrieked, knowledge is power. And a dwarf on a giant's shoulder sees the farthest of the two. And I summed my side up with rare serenity in the folly of mistaking a metaphor for a proof, a torrent of verbiage for a spring of capital truths, and oneself as an oracle, is inborn in us, Mr. Valerie once said. Montag's head whirled, sickeningly. He felt beaten unmercifully on brow, eyes, nose, lips, chin, on shoulders, on upflailing arms. He wanted to yell, no, shut up, you're confusing things, stop it. Beatty's graceful fingers thrust out to seize his wrist. God, what a pulse. I've got you going, have I, Montag? Jesus, God, your pulse sounds like the day after the war. Everything but sirens and bells. Shall I talk some more? I like your look of panic. Swahili, Indian, English lit, I speak them all. A kind of excellent dumb discourse, Willie. Montag, hold on. The moth brushed Montag's ear. He's muddying the waters. Oh, you were scared, silly, said Beatty. For I was doing a terrible thing in using the very books you clung to rebut you on every hand, on every point. What traitor's books can be? You think they're backing you up and they turn on you. Others can use them too, and there you are, lost in the middle of the moor in a great welter of nouns and verbs and adjectives. And at the very end of my dream, along I came with the salamander and said, going my way? And you got in, and we drove back to the firehouse in beatific silence. All dwindled away to peace. Beatty let Montag's wrist go, let the hand slump limply on the table. All's well that is well in the end. Silence. Montag sat like a carved white stone. The echo of the final hammer on his skull died slowly away into the black cavern where Faber waited for the echoes to subside. And then when the startled dust had settled down about Montag's mind, Faber began softly. All right, he's had his say. You must take it in. I'll say my say, too, in the next few hours. And you'll take it in. And you'll try to judge them and make your decisions as to which way to jump or fall. But I want it to be your decision, not mine, and not the captain's. But remember that the captain belongs to the most dangerous enemy to truth and freedom, the solid, unmoving cattle of the majority. Oh, God, the terrible tyranny of the majority. We all have our harps to play, and it's up to you now to know with which ear you'll listen. Montag opened his mouth to answer Faber and was saved this error in the presence of others when the station bell rang. The alarm voice in the ceiling chanted. There was a tacking-tacking sound as the alarm report telephone typed out the address across the room. Captain Beatty, his poker cards in one pink hand, walked with exaggerated slowness to the phone and ripped out the address when the report was finished. He glanced perfunctorily at it and shoved it in his pocket. He came back and sat down. The others looked at him. It can wait exactly 40 seconds while I take all the money away from you, said Beatty happily. Montag put his cards down. Tired, Montag? Going out of this game?
Yes.
Hold on. Well, come to think of it,
We can finish this hand later. Just leave your cards face down and hustle the equipment. On the double now.
And Beatty rose up again.
Montag, you don't look well. I'd hate to think you were coming down with another fever.
I'll be all right.
You'll be fine. This is a special case. Come on, jump for it.
They leapt into the air and clutched the brass pole as if it were the last vantage point above a tidal wave passing below. And then the brass pole, to their dismay, slid them down into darkness, into the blast and cough and suction of the gaseous dragon roaring to life.
Hey!
They rounded a corner in thunder and siren, with concussion of tires, with scream of rubber, with a shift of kerosene bulk in the glittery brass tank, like the food in the stomach of a giant, with Montag's fingers jolting off the silver rail, swinging into cold space, with the wind tearing his hair back from his head, with the wind whistling in his teeth, and him all the while thinking of the women. The chaff women in his parlor tonight, with the kernels blown out from under them by a neon wind, and his silly damned reading of a book to them. How like trying to put out fires with water pistols, how senseless and insane. One rage turned in for another, one anger displacing another. When would he stop being entirely mad and be quiet? Be very quiet indeed.
Here we go.
Montag looked up. Beatty never drove, but he was driving tonight, slamming the salamander around corners, leaning forward high on the driver's throne, his massive black slicker flapping out behind, so that he seemed a great black bat flying above the engine, over the brass numbers, taking the full wind.
Here we go to keep the world happy, Montag.
Beatty's pink, phosphorescent cheeks glimmered in the high darkness, and he was smiling furiously.
Here we are.
The salamander boomed to a halt, throwing men off in slips and clumsy hops. Montag stood, fixing his raw eyes to the cold, bright rail under his clenched fingers.
I can't do it, he thought. How can I go with this new assignment? How can I go on burning things? I can't go in this place.
Beatty, smelling of the wind through which he had rushed, was at Montag's elbow.
All right, Montag.
The men ran like cripples in their clumsy boots, as quietly as spiders. At last, Montag raised his eyes and turned. Beatty was watching his face.
Something the matter, Montag?
Why, said Montag slowly, we've stopped in front of my house.
Part 3. Burning Bright. Lights flicked on, and house doors opened all down the street to watch the carnival set up. Montag and Beatty stared, one with dry satisfaction, the other with disbelief, at the house before them, this main ring in which torches would be juggled and fire eaten.
Well, said Beatty, now you did it. Old Montag wanted to fly near the sun, and now that he's burnt his damn wings, he wonders why. Didn't I hint enough when I sent the hound around your place?
Montag's face was entirely numb and featureless. He felt his head turn like a stone carving to the dark place next door, set in its bright border of flowers. Beatty snorted.
Oh, no. You weren't fooled by that little idiot's routine, were you? Flowers, butterflies, leaves, sunsets? Oh, hell. It's all in a file. I'll be damned, I've hit the bullseye. Look at the sick look on your face. A few grass blades and the quarters of the moon, what trash. What good did she ever do with all that?
Montag sat on the cold fender of the dragon, moving his head half an inch to the left, half an inch to the right, left, right, left, right, left.
She saw everything. She didn't do anything to anyone. She just let them alone.
Alone, hell! She chewed around you, didn't she? One of those damn do-gooders with their shocked, holier-than-thou silences. Their one talent, making others feel guilty. God damn you, they rise like the midnight sun to sweat you in your bed.
The front door opened. Mildred came down the steps running, one suitcase held with a dreamlike, clenching rigidity in her fist, as a beetle taxi hissed to the curb. Mildred! She ran past, with her body stiff, her face flowered with powder, her mouth gone. without lipstick. Mildred, you didn't put in the alarm!
She shoved the valise in the waiting Beetle, climbed in, and sat mumbling.
Poor family. Poor family. Oh, everything gone. Everything. Everything gone now.
Beatty grabbed Montag's shoulder as the Beetle blasted away and hit 70 miles an hour, far down the street. Gone. There was a crash, like the falling parts of a dream, fashioned out of warped glass, mirrors, and crystal prisms. Montag drifted about as if still another incomprehensible storm had turned him, to see Stoneman and Black wielding axes, shattering window panes to provide cross-ventilation. The brush of a death's head moth against a cold black screen. Montag, this is Faber. Do you hear me? What's happening?
This is happening to me, said Montag.
What a dreadful surprise, said Beatty. For everyone nowadays knows, absolutely is certain, that nothing will ever happen to me. Others die, I go on. There are no consequences and no responsibilities. Except that there are. But let's not talk about them, eh? By the time the consequences catch up with you, it's too late, isn't it, Montag?
Montag, can you get away? Run, asked Faber.
Montag walked, but did not feel his feet touch the cement, and then the night grasses. Beatty flicked his igniter nearby, and the small orange flame drew his fascinated gaze.
What is there about fire that's so lovely? No matter what age we are, what draws us to it?
Beatty blew out the flame and lit it again.
It's perpetual motion. The thing man wanted to invent but never did. Or almost perpetual motion. If you let it go on, it'd burn our lifetimes out. What is fire? It's a mystery. Scientists give us gobbledygook about friction and molecules, but they don't really know. Its real beauty is that it destroys responsibility and consequences. A problem gets too burdensome, then into the furnace with it. Now, Montag, you're a burden. And the fire will lift you off my shoulders, clean, quick, sure. Nothing to rot later. Antibiotic. Aesthetic. Practical.
Montag stood looking in now at this queer house, made strange by the hour of the night, by murmuring neighbor voices, by littered glass. And there on the floor, their covers torn off and spilled out like swan feathers, the incredible books that looked so silly and really not worth bothering with, for these were nothing but black type and yellowed paper and raveled binding.
Mildred, of course. She must have watched him hide the books in the garden and brought them back in. Mildred. Mildred.
I want you to do this job all by your lonesome, Montag. Not with kerosene and a match, but piecework with a flamethrower. Your house, your cleanup.
Montag, can't you run? Get away.
No, cried Montag helplessly. The hound. Because of the hound.
Faber heard, and Beatty, thinking it was meant for him, heard.
Yes, the hound's somewhere about the neighborhood, so don't try anything.
Ready? Ready.
Montag snapped the safety catch on the flamethrower.
Fire!
A great nuzzling gout of fire leapt out to lap at the books and knock them against the wall. He stepped into the bedroom, and fired twice, and the twin beds went up in a great simmering whisper, with more heat and passion and light than he would have supposed them to contain. He burnt the bedroom walls and the cosmetics chest because he wanted to change everything, the chairs, the tables, and in the dining room, the silverware and plastic dishes, everything that showed that he had lived here in this empty house with a strange woman who would forget him tomorrow, who had gone and quite forgotten him already, listening to her seashell radio pour in on her, and in on her as she rode across town alone. And as before, it was good to burn. He felt himself gush out in the fire, snatch, rend, rip in half with flame, and put away the senseless problem. If there was no solution, well, then now there was no problem either. Fire was best for everything. The books, Montag. The books leapt and danced like roasted birds, their wings ablaze with red and yellow feathers. and then he came to the parlor, where the great idiot monsters lay asleep with their white thoughts and their snowy dreams. And he shot a bolt at each of the three blank walls, and the vacuum hissed out at him. The emptiness made an even emptier whistle, a senseless scream. He tried to think about the vacuum upon which the nothingnesses had performed. But he could not. He held his breath so the vacuum could not get into his lungs. He cut off its terrible emptiness, drew back, and gave the entire room a gift of one huge, bright yellow flower of burning. The fireproof plastic sheath on everything was cut wide, and the house began to shudder with flame. "When you're quite finished," said Beatty behind him, "you're under arrest." The house fell in red coals and black ash. It bedded itself down in sleepy pink-gray cinders, and a smoke plume blew over it, rising and waving slowly back and forth in the sky. It was 3:30 in the morning. The crowd drew back into the houses. The great tents of the circus had slumped into charcoal and rubble, and the show was well over. Montag stood with the flamethrower in his limp hands, great islands of perspiration drenching his armpits, his face smeared with soot. The other firemen waited behind him in the darkness, their faces illumined faintly by the smoldering foundation. Montag started to speak twice, and then finally managed to put his thought together. "Was it my wife turned in the alarm?" Beatty nodded. "But her friends turned in an alarm earlier that I let ride. One way or the other, you'd have got it. It was pretty silly, quoting poetry around free and easy like that. It was the act of a silly damn snob. Give a man a few lines of verse and he thinks he's the lord of all creation. You think you can walk on water with your books? Well, the world can get by just fine without them. Look where they got you, in slime up to your lip. If I stir the slime with my little finger, you'll drown." Montag could not move. A great earthquake had come with fire and leveled the house, and Mildred was under there somewhere, and his entire life under there, and he could not move. The earthquake was still shaking and falling and shivering inside him, and he stood there, his knees half bent under the great load of tiredness and bewilderment and outrage, letting Beatty hit him without raising a hand. "Montag, you idiot. Montag, you damn fool. Why did you really do it?" Montag did not hear. He was far away. He was running with his mind. He was gone, leaving this dead, soot-covered body to sway in front of another raving fool.
"Montag, get out of there," said Faber.
Montag listened. Beatty struck him a blow on the head that sent him reeling back. The green bullet in which Faber's voice whispered and cried fell to the sidewalk. Beatty snatched it up, grinning. He held it half in, half out of his ear. Montag heard the distant voice calling,
"Montag, you all right?"
Beatty switched the green bullet off and thrust it in his pocket.
"Well, so there's more here than I thought. I saw you tilt your head listening. First I thought you had a seashell, but when you turned clever later I wondered, we'll trace this and drop it on your friend."
"No,"
said Montag. He twitched the safety catch on the flamethrower. Beatty glanced instantly at Montag's fingers, and his eyes widened the faintest bit. Montag saw the surprise there, and himself glanced to his hands to see what new thing they had done. Thinking back later, he could never decide whether the hands, or Beatty's reaction to the hands, gave him the final push toward murder. The last rolling thunder of the avalanche stoned down about his ears, not touching him. Beatty grinned his most charming grin.
"Well, that's one way to get an audience. Hold a gun on a man and force him to listen to your speech. Speech away. What'll it be this time? Why don't you belt Shakespeare at me, you fumbling snob? There is no terror, Cassius, in your threats, for I am armed so strong in honesty that they pass me as an idle wind, which I respect not. How's that? Go ahead now, you second-hand literateur, pull the trigger."
He took one step toward Montag. Montag only said,
"We never burned right."
"Hand it over, guy," said Beatty with a fixed smile.
And then he was a shrieking blaze, A jumping, sprawling, gibbering mannequin, no longer human or known. All writhing flame on the lawn as Montag shot one continuous pulse of liquid fire on him. There was a hiss, like a great mouthful of spittle banging a red-hot stove, a bubbling and frothing, as if salt had been poured over a monstrous black snail to cause a terrible liquefaction and a boiling over of yellow foam. Montag shut his eyes, shouted, and fought to get his hands at his ears to clamp and to cut away the sound. Beatty flopped over and over and over, and at last twisted in on himself like a charred wax doll and lay silent. The other two firemen did not move. Montag kept his sickness down long enough to aim the flamethrower.
"Turn around."
They turned, their faces blanched meat, streaming sweat. He beat their heads, knocking off their helmets and bringing them down on themselves. They fell and lay without moving. The blowing of a single autumn leaf. He turned, and the mechanical hound was there. It was half across the lawn, coming from the shadows, moving with such drifting ease that it was like a single solid cloud of black-gray smoke blown at him in silence. It made a single last leap into the air, coming down at Montag from a good 3 feet over his head, its spidered legs reaching, the procaine needle snapping out its single angry tooth. Montag caught it with a bloom of fire, a single wondrous blossom that curled in petals of yellow and blue and orange about the metal dog, clad it in a new covering as it slammed into Montag and threw him 10 feet back against the bole of a tree, taking the flame gun with him. He felt it scrabble and seize his leg and stab the needle in for a moment. Before the fire snapped the hound up in the air, burst its metal bones at the joints, and blew out its interior in a single flushing of red color like a skyrocket fastened to the street. Montag lay watching the dead, alive thing fiddle the air and die. Even now it seemed to want to get back at him and finish the injection, which was now working through the flesh of his leg. He felt all of the mingled relief and horror at having pulled back only in time to have just his knee slammed by the fender of a car hurtling by at 90 miles an hour. He was afraid to get up, afraid he might not be able to gain his feet at all with an anesthetized leg. A numbness in a numbness hollowed into a numbness. And now? The street empty, the house burnt like an ancient bit of stage scenery, the other homes dark. The hound here, Beatty there, the two other firemen another place, and the salamander? He gazed at the immense engine. That would have to go too. Well, he thought, let's see how badly off you are. On your feet now. Easy, easy. There. He stood, and he had only one leg. The other was like a chunk of burnt pine log he was carrying along as a penance for some obscure sin. When he put his weight on it, a shower of silver needles gushed up the length of the calf and went off in the knee. He wept. Come on. Come on, you. You can't stay here. A few house lights were going on again down the street. Whether from the incidents just passed or because of the abnormal silence following the fight, Montag did not know. He hobbled around the ruins, seizing at his bad leg when it lagged, talking and whimpering and shouting directions at it and cursing it and pleading with it to work for him now when it was vital. He heard a number of people crying out in the darkness and shouting. He reached the backyard and the alley. Beatty, he thought, you're not a problem now. You always said don't face a problem, burn it. Well, now I've done both. Goodbye, Captain. And he stumbled along the alley in the dark. A shotgun blast went off in his leg every time he put it down, and he thought, you're a fool, a damn fool, an awful fool, an idiot, an awful idiot, and a fool, a damn fool. Look at the mess, and where's the mop? Look at the mess. And what do? Pride, damn it, and temper, and you've junked it all at the very start. You vomit on everyone and on yourself. But everything one on top of another. Beatty, the women, Mildred, Clarice, everything. No excuse, though, no excuse. A fool, a damn fool, go give yourself up. No, we'll save what we can.
We'll do what there is left to do. If we have to burn, let's take a few more with us. Here.
He remembered the books and turned back, just on the off chance. He found a few books where he had left them near the garden fence. Mildred, God bless her, had missed a few. 4 books still lay hidden where he had put them. Voices were wailing in the night, and flash beams swirled about. Other salamanders were roaring, their engines far away, and police sirens were cutting their way across town with their sirens. Montag took the 4 remaining books, and hopped his way down the alley, and suddenly fell, as if his head had been cut off and only his body lay there. Something inside had jerked him to a halt and flopped him down. He lay where he had fallen, and sobbed, his legs folded, his face pressed blindly to the gravel. Beatty wanted to die. In the middle of the crying, Montag knew it for the truth. Beatty had wanted to die. He had just stood there, not really trying to save himself, just stood there, joking, needling, thought Montag. And the thought was enough to stifle his sobbing and let him pause for air. How strange, strange, to want to die so much, that you let a man walk around armed, and then instead of shutting up and staying alive, you go on yelling at people and making fun of them, until you get them mad. And then, at a distance, running feet, Montag sat up. Let's get out of here. Come on, get up. Get up. You just can't sit. But he was still crying, and that had to be finished. It was going away now. He hadn't wanted to kill anyone. Not even Beatty. His flesh gripped him and shrank, as if it had been plunged in acid. He gagged. He saw Beatty, a torch, not moving, fluttering out on the grass. He bit at his knuckles.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Oh, God, sorry.
He tried to piece it all together, to go back to the normal pattern of life a few short days ago. Before the sieve and the sand, Denham's dentifrice, moth voices, fireflies, the alarms and excursions, too much for a few short days. Too much indeed for a lifetime. Feet ran in the far end of the alley.
Get up, he told himself. Damn it, get up, he said to the leg, and stood.
The pains were spikes driven in the kneecap. And then only darning needles, and then only common ordinary safety pins. And after he had shagged along 50 more hops and jumps, filling his hand with slivers from the board fence, the prickling was like someone blowing a spray of scalding water on that leg. And the leg was at last his own leg again. He had been afraid that running might break the loose ankle. Now, sucking all the night into his open mouth and blowing it out, pale, with all the blackness left heavily inside himself, he set out in a steady jogging pace. He carried the books in his hands. He thought of Faber. Faber was back there in the steaming lump of tar that had no name or identity now. He had burnt Faber, too. He suddenly felt so shocked by this that he felt Faber was really dead, baked like a roach in that small green capsule shoved and lost in the pocket of a man who was now nothing but a frame skeleton strung with asphalt tendons. You must remember, burn them, or they'll burn you, he thought. Right now it's as simple as that. He searched his pockets. The money was there. And in his other pocket he found the usual seashell upon which the city was talking to itself in the cold black morning.
Police alert. Wanted. Fugitive in city. Has committed murder and crimes against the state. Name, Guy Montag. Occupation, fireman. Last seen.
He ran steadily for 6 blocks in the alley. And then the alley opened out into a wide, empty thoroughfare 10 lanes wide. It seemed like a boatless river frozen there in the raw light of the high white arc lamps. You could drown trying to cross it, he felt. It was too wide. It was too open. It was a vast stage without scenery, inviting him to run across, easily seen in the blazing illumination, easily caught, easily shot down. The seashell hummed in his ear.
Watch for a man running. Watch for the running man. Watch for a man alone on foot. Watch.
Montag pulled back in the shadows. Directly ahead lay a gas station, a great chunk of porcelain snow shining there, and two silver beetles pulling in to fill up. Now he must be clean and presentable if he wished to walk, not run, stroll calmly across that wide boulevard. It would give him an extra margin of safety if he washed up and combed his hair before he went on his way to get... where? Yes, he thought. Where am I running? Nowhere. There was nowhere to go. No friend to turn to, really. Except Faber. And then he realized that he was indeed running toward Faber's house instinctively. But Faber couldn't hide him. It would be suicide even to try. But he knew that he would go to see Faber anyway, for a few short minutes. Faber's would be the place where he might refuel his fast-draining belief in his own ability to survive. He just wanted to know that there was a man like Faber in the world. He wanted to see the man alive, and not burnt back there like a body shelled in another body. And some of the money must be left with Faber, of course, to be spent after Montag ran on his way. Perhaps he could make the open country and live on or near the rivers and near the highways in the fields and hills. A great whirling whisper made him look to the sky. The police helicopters were rising so far away that it seemed someone had blown the gray head off a dry dandelion flower. 2 dozen of them flurried, wavering, indecisive, 3 miles off, like butterflies puzzled by autumn. And then they were plummeting down to land one by one, here, there, softly kneading the streets, where, turned back to beetles, they shrieked along the boulevards, or as suddenly, leapt back into the air, continuing their search. And here was the gas station, its attendants busy now with customers. Approaching from the rear, Montag entered the men's washroom. Through the aluminum wall, he heard a radio voice saying, "War has been declared." The gas was being pumped outside. The men in the beetles were talking, and the attendants were talking about the engines, the gas, the money owed. Montag stood trying to make himself feel the shock of the quiet statement from the radio. But nothing would happen. The war would have to wait for him to come to it in his personal file. 1 hour, 2 hours from now. He washed his hands and face and toweled himself dry, making little sound. He came out of the washroom and shut the door carefully, and walked into the darkness, and at last stood again on the edge of the empty boulevard. There it lay. A game for him to win. A vast bowling alley in the cool morning. The boulevard was as clean as the surface of an arena 2 minutes before the appearance of certain unnamed victims and certain unknown killers. The air over and above the vast concrete river trembled with the warmth of Montag's body alone. It was incredible how he felt his temperature could cause the whole immediate world to vibrate. He was a phosphorescent target. He knew it. He felt it. And now he must begin his little walk. 3 blocks away, a few headlights glared. Montag drew a deep breath. His lungs were like burning brooms in his chest. His mouth was sucked dry from running. His throat tasted of bloody iron, and there was rusted steel in his feet. What about those lights there? Once you started walking, you'd have to gauge how fast those beetles could make it down here. Well, how far was it to the other curb? It seemed like 100 yards. Probably not 100, but figure for that anyway. Figure that with him going very slowly at a nice stroll, it might take as much as 30 seconds, 40 seconds to walk all that way. The beetles? Once started, they could leave 3 blocks behind them in about 15 seconds. So even if halfway across he started to run, he put his right foot out, and then his left foot, and then his right. He walked on the empty avenue. Even if the street were entirely empty, of course, you couldn't be sure of a safe crossing, for a car could appear suddenly over the rise 4 blocks farther on and be on and past you before you had taken 12 breaths. He decided not to count his steps. He looked neither to left nor right. The light from the overhead lamp seemed as bright and revealing as the midday sun, and just as hot. He listened to the sound of the car picking up speed 2 blocks away on his right. Its movable headlights jerked back and forth suddenly and caught at Montag. Keep going. Montag faltered, got a grip on the books, and forced himself not to freeze. Instinctively, he took a few quick running steps, then talked out loud to himself and pulled up to stroll again. He was now half across the street, but the roar from the Beetle's engines whined higher as it put on speed. The police, of course, they see me. But slow now, slow, quiet, don't turn, don't look, don't seem concerned. Walk, that's it. Walk. Walk. The Beetle was rushing. The Beetle was roaring. The Beetle raised its speed. The Beetle was whining. The Beetle was in high thunder. The Beetle came skimming. The Beetle came in a single whistling trajectory, fired from an invisible rifle. It was up to 120 miles per hour. It was up to 130 at least. Montag clamped his jaws. The heat of the racing headlights burnt his cheeks, it seemed, and jittered his eyelids and flushed the sour sweat out all over his body. He began to shuffle idiotically and talk to himself, and then he broke and just ran. He put out his legs as far as they would go and down and then far out again and down and back and out and down and back. God. God. He dropped a book, broke pace, almost turned, changed his mind, plunged on, yelling in concrete emptiness, the Beetle scuttling after its running food. 200. 100 feet away. 90. 80. 70. Montag gasping, flailing his hands, legs, up, down, out, up, down, out, closer, closer, hooting, calling. His eyes burnt white now as his head jerked about to confront the flashing glare. Now the Beetle was swallowed in its own light. Now it was nothing but a torch hurtling upon him, all sound, all blare. Now, almost on top of him. He stumbled and fell. I'm done. It's over. But the falling made a difference. An instant before reaching him, the wild Beetle cut and swerved out. It was gone. Montag lay flat, his head down. Wisps of laughter trailed back to him with the blue exhaust from the Beetle. His right hand was extended above him, flat. Across the extreme tip of his middle finger, he saw now, as he lifted that hand, a faint 1/16 of an inch of black tread where the tire had touched in passing. He looked at that black line, with disbelief, getting to his feet. That wasn't the police, he thought. He looked down the boulevard. It was clear now. A car full of children, all ages, God knew, from 12 to 16, out whistling, yelling, hurrahing, had seen a man, a very extraordinary sight, a man strolling, a rarity, and simply said, "Let's get him," not knowing he was the fugitive Mr. Montag. Simply a number of children out for a long night of roaring 500 or 600 miles in a few moonlit hours. Their faces icy with wind, and coming home or not coming at dawn, alive or not alive, that made the adventure. They would have killed me, thought Montag, swaying. The air still torn and stirring about him in dust, touching his bruised cheek. For no reason at all in the world, they would have killed me. He walked toward the far curb, telling each foot to go and keep going. Somehow he had picked up the spilled books. He didn't remember bending or touching them. He kept moving them from hand to hand as if they were a poker hand he could not figure. I wonder if they were the ones who killed Clarice. He stopped, and his mind said it again very loud. I wonder if they were the ones who killed Clarice. He wanted to run after them, yelling. His eyes watered. The thing that had saved him was falling flat. The driver of that car, seeing Montag down, instinctively considered the probability that running over a body at such a high speed might turn the car upside down and spill them out. If Montag had remained an upright target, Montag gasped. Far down the boulevard, four blocks away, the Beetle had slowed, spun about on two wheels, and was now racing back, slanting over on the wrong side of the street, picking up speed. But Montag was gone. Hidden in the safety of the dark alley for which he had set out on a long journey, an hour, or was it a minute, ago. He stood shivering in the night, looking back out as the Beetle ran by and skidded back to the center of the avenue, whirling laughter in the air all about it. Gone. Farther on, as Montag moved in darkness, He could see the helicopters falling, falling like the first flakes of snow in the long winter to come. The house was silent. Montag approached from the rear, creeping through a thick, night-moistened scent of daffodils and roses and wet grass. He touched the screen door in back, found it open, slipped in, moved across the porch, listening. "Mrs. Black, are you asleep in there?" he thought. "This isn't good. But your husband did it to others, and never asked, and never wondered, and never worried. And now, since you're a fireman's wife, it's your house and your turn. For all the houses your husband burnt, and the people he hurt, without thinking." The house did not reply. He hid the books in the kitchen, and moved from the house again to the alley, and looked back. And the house was still dark and quiet, sleeping. On his way across town, with the helicopters fluttering like torn bits of paper in the sky, he phoned the alarm at a lonely phone booth outside a store that was closed for the night. Then he stood in the cold night air waiting, and at a distance he heard the fire sirens start up and run, and the salamanders coming, coming to burn Mr. Black's house while he was away at work, to make his wife stand shivering in the morning air while the roof let go and dropped in upon the fire. But now she was still asleep. "Good night, Mrs. Black," he thought.
"Faber."
Another rap, a whisper, and a long waiting. Then, after a minute, a small light flickered inside Faber's small house. After another pause, the back door opened. They stood looking at each other in the half-light, Faber and Montag, as if each did not believe in the other's existence. Then Faber moved and put out his hand, and grabbed Montag and moved him in and sat him down and went back and stood in the door listening. The sirens were wailing off in the morning distance. He came in and shut the door. Montag said, "I've been a fool all down the line. I can't stay long. I'm on my way, God knows where."
"At least you were a fool about the right things," said Faber. "I thought you were dead. The audio capsule I gave you?
Burnt.
I heard the captain talking to you, and suddenly there was nothing. I almost came out looking for you."
"The captain's dead. He found the audio capsule, he heard your voice, he was going to trace it. I killed him with the flamethrower." Faber sat down and did not speak for a time.
"My God, how did this happen?" said Montag. "It was only the other night everything was fine, and the next thing I know I'm drowning. How many times can a man go down and still be alive? I can't breathe. There's Beatty, dead, and he was my friend once. And there's Millie, gone. I thought she was my wife, but now I don't know. And the house, all burnt. And my job gone, and myself on the run, and I planted a book in a fireman's house on the way. Good Christ, the things I've done in a single week."
"You did what you had to do. It was coming on for a long time."
"Yes, I believe that. If there's nothing else I believe, it saved itself up to happen. I could feel it for a long time. I was saving something up. I went around doing one thing and feeling another. God, it was all there. It's a wonder it didn't show on me, like fat. And now here I am messing up your life too. They might follow me here."
"I feel alive for the first time in years," said Faber. "I feel I'm doing what I should have done a lifetime ago. For a little while, I'm not afraid. Maybe it's because I'm doing the right thing at last. Maybe it's because I've done a rash thing and don't want to look the coward to you. I suppose I'll have to do even more violent things, exposing myself so I won't fall down on the job and turn scared again. What are your plans?"
"To keep running."
"You know the war's on."
"I heard."
"God, isn't it funny?" said the old man. "It seems so remote. Because we have our own troubles."
"I haven't had time to think."
Montag drew out $100.
"I want this to stay with you. Use it any way that'll help when I'm gone."
"But
I might be dead by noon. Use this."
Faber nodded.
"You'd better head for the river, if you can. Follow along it. And if you hit the old railroad lines going out into the country, follow them. Even though practically everything's airborne these days and most of the tracks are abandoned, the rails are still there, rusting. I've heard there are still hobo camps all across the country here and there.
walking camps, they call them. And if you keep walking far enough and keep an eye peeled, they say there's lots of old Harvard degrees on the tracks between here and Los Angeles. Most of them are wanted and hunted in the cities. They survive, I guess. There aren't many of them, and I guess the government's never considered them a great enough danger to go in and track them down. You might hole up with them for a time, and get in touch with me in St. Louis. I'm leaving on the 5 a.m. bus this morning to see a retired printer there. I'm getting out in the open myself, at last. This money will be put to good use. Thanks, and God bless you. Do you want to sleep a few minutes?
I'd better run.
Let's check.
He took Montag quickly into the bedroom and lifted a picture frame aside, revealing a television screen the size of a postal card.
I always wanted something very small, something I could walk to, something I could blot out with the palm of my hand if necessary. Nothing that could shout me down, nothing monstrous big. So, you see,
he snapped it on.
Montag, the TV set said, and lit up. M-O-N-T-A-G.
The name was spelled out by a voice.
Guy Montag. Still running? Police helicopters are up. A new mechanical hound has been brought from another district.
Montag and Faber looked at each other.
Mechanical hound. Never fails. Never since its first use in tracking quarry has this incredible invention made a mistake. Tonight, this network is proud to have the opportunity to follow the hound by camera helicopter as it starts on its way to the target.
Faber poured two glasses of whiskey.
We'll need these.
They drank.
Nose so sensitive, the mechanical hound can remember and identify 10,000 odor indexes on 10,000 men without resetting.
Faber trembled the least bit and looked about at his house, at the walls, the doorknob, and the chair where Montag now sat. Montag saw the look. They both looked quickly about the house, and Montag felt his nostrils dilate, and he knew that he was trying to track himself, and his nose was suddenly good enough to sense the path he had made in the air of the room, and the sweat of his hand hung from the doorknob, invisible, but as numerous as the jewels of a small chandelier. He was a luminous cloud, a ghost that made breathing once more impossible. He saw Faber stop up his own breath for fear of drawing that ghost into his own body, perhaps, being contaminated with the phantom exhalations and odors of a running man.
The mechanical hound is now landing by a helicopter at the site of the burning.
And there on the small screen was the burnt house and the crowd, and something with a sheet over it. And out of the sky, fluttering, came the helicopter like a grotesque flower.
So they must have their game out, thought Montag. The circus must go on, even with war beginning within the hour.
He watched the scene, fascinated, not wanting to move. It seemed so remote, and no part of him. It was a play apart and separate, wondrous to watch, not without its strange pleasure. That's all for me, he thought. That's all taking place just for me, by God. If he wished, he could linger here in comfort and follow the entire hunt on through its swift phases, down alleys, across streets, over empty running avenues, crossing lots and playgrounds, with pauses here or there for the necessary commercials, up other alleys to the burning house of Mr. and Mrs. Black, and so on, finally to this house, with Faber and himself seated drinking, while the electric hound snuffed down the last trail, silent as a drift of death itself, skidding to a halt outside that window there. Then, if he wished, Montag might rise, walk to the window, keep one eye on the TV screen, open the window, lean out, look back, and see himself dramatized, described, made over, standing there, limned in the bright small television screen from outside. A drama, to be watched objectively, knowing that in other parlors he was large as life in full color, dimensionally perfect, and if he kept his eye peeled quickly, he would see himself an instant before oblivion being punctured for the benefit of how many civilian parlor sitters who had been wakened from sleep a few minutes ago by the frantic sirening of their living room walls to come watch the big game, the hunt, the one-man carnival. Would he have time for a speech? As the hound seized him in view of 10 or 20 or 30 million people, mightn't he sum up his entire life in the last week in one single phrase or a word that would stay with them long after the hound had turned, clenching him in its metal plier jaws, and trotted off in darkness, while the camera remained stationary, watching the creature dwindle in the distance, a splendid fade-out. What could he say in a single word, a few words, that would sear all their faces and wake them up? "There," whispered Faber. Out of a helicopter glided something that was not machine, not animal, not dead, not alive, glowing with a pale green luminosity. It stood near the smoking ruins of Montag's house, and the men brought his discarded flamethrower to it and put it down under the muzzle of the hound. There was a whirring, clicking, humming. Montag shook his head and got up and drank the rest of his drink. "It's time. I'm sorry about this."
"About what? Me? My house? I deserve everything. Run, for God's sake. Perhaps I can delay them here."
"Wait. There's no use you being discovered. When I leave, burn the spread of this bed that I touched. Burn the chair in the living room, in your room, and your wall incinerator. Wipe down the furniture with alcohol, wipe the doorknobs, burn the throw rug in the parlor. Turn the air conditioning on full in all the rooms, and spray with moth spray if you have it. Then turn on your lawn sprinklers as high as they'll go and hose off the sidewalks. With any luck at all, we can kill the trail in here anyway." Faber shook his hand.
"I'll tend to it. Good luck. If we're both in good health next week, the week after, get in touch. General delivery, St. Louis. I'm sorry there's no way I can go with you this time by earphone. That was good for both of us. But my equipment was limited. You see, I never thought I would use it. What a silly old man. No thought there. Stupid, stupid. So I haven't another green bullet, the right kind, to put in your head. Go now.
One last thing, quick. A suitcase. Get it. Fill it with your dirtiest clothes, an old suit. The dirtier the better. A shirt, some old sneakers and socks." Faber was gone and back in a minute. They sealed the cardboard valise with clear tape.
"To keep the ancient odor of Mr. Faber in, of course," said Faber, sweating at the job.
Montag doused the exterior of the valise with whiskey. "I don't want the hound picking up two odors at once. May I take this whiskey? I'll need it later. Christ, I hope this works." They shook hands again, and going out the door glanced at the TV. The hound was on its way, followed by hovering helicopter cameras, silently, silently sniffing the great night wind. It was running down the first alley. "Goodbye." And Montag was out the back door lightly, running with the half-empty valise. Behind him, he heard the lawn sprinkling system jump up, filling the dark air with rain that fell gently, and then with a steady pour all about, washing on the sidewalks and draining into the alley. He carried a few drops of this rain with him on his face. He thought he heard the old man call goodbye, but wasn't certain. He ran very fast away from the house down toward the river.